Hi, David.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. Greetings from Toronto.
And greetings from the Garden State. Thanks for joining us. If there's anyone out there who doesn't know you, hard to imagine, but if there is, you're David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic.
Correct.
Anything else you'd like to say on your behalf?
I think that sort of covers
that's the most flattering way we can describe it.
Contrary to your assurances, there are, I think, billions and billions of people who don't know anything about it.
Well, we're about to take care of that, David.
Exactly. This is the blogging heads bump.
Yeah. Yeah. Watch those Amazon numbers. Let's lead with the news. You were involved in a controversy recently, a faked photo controversy. You did not fake a photo, but you confidently asserted, I would say, on Twitter that a photo published in the New York Times was faked, later conceded that it was not. And what would you say about, and this was a Gaza. This is Gaza. It was a picture of, I guess, a wounded Palestinian being consoled by.
It was two people who, they were not themselves wounded, but they were covered in blood.
Okay.
After a family member seems to have been killed. There are different stories about what exactly was the backdrop, but I'm satisfied now that the photographer took the picture as he saw it, that it was not in any way organized for him. I'm pretty active on Twitter, and normally I do a pretty good job, I think, of counting to 10 and holding my breath and counting to 10 before reacting. It's a very tempting medium to overreact to. This happens to people. It's happened to friends of mine. Sometimes, though, you slip, you react too quickly, or you lose your temper, and you fire off things when without enough consideration. And so that's what happened to me, and I regret it. Twitter is not exactly like writing a column. Typically, you don't research a tweet, mm-hmm. But normally you want to be circumspect in what you say. And if you're not exactly sure that something is right, you want to say it in a more hedged or careful way. And I just didn't do that, and I regret that. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry especially to the New York Times photographer who runs a lot of risks, is in a dangerous situation. Photographers are it's an incredibly dangerous job, and they don't deserve to get quibbled at without real confidence that something wrong has happened.
And there was a blog or something that was asserting that it was faked. I mean, was it that it looked suspicious to you, and then you came in contact with these other suspicions, or
what happened? First, as you know, there's a long history of fake photography coming out of the Middle East these conflicts. Most notoriously, the incident with the photographer who worked for Reuters during the Lebanon War in 2006, who's I think Reuters ultimately had to take down many hundreds, maybe almost 1,000 photographs that were taken by this particular photographer. In this case, what struck me was these pictures were so composed that they looked like almost like works of art. That's not an inappropriate thing to say about people who are covered with blood and suffering. But they were very framed and composed. And so it was an image that we've all seen a lot of bad images from Gaza, and you know that clearly it's a war zone. People are getting hurt. But there was something about this that seemed kind of artistic. And then I was forwarded a blog post where somebody had a series of attacks on the or doubts to cast on the picture. And then without doing enough work on it of my own, I accepted it and tweeted it.
Yeah, I think the blogger claimed to have some kind of killer evidence about in one picture there's blood on the arm and the others is not. Anyway, that was all resolved to your satisfaction once the Times photographer explained the sequence. And I gather he sent the whole sequence of photographs to his the people at the Times, to his boss, and so on.
Right. So I know. So as I say, I wish I could say it will be the last mistake I will make in my journalistic career. It certainly wasn't the first. It's just one of the things that happens. And for those of us who grew up under print, it's one of the things that is sort of difficult about adjusting to the new era is we have to work faster than we did 20 and 30 years ago. And that means we make more mistakes. And you have to it's very hard because in the days of print, I mean, a mistake just followed you forever. In the internet era, that what we have to accept is we're going to make mistakes, sometimes serious ones, and the only way to deal with it is to be responsive when people challenge you, to correct quickly, and to try to do better, but also have an understanding of the limits of what you do in the age of instantaneous media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have definitely sent ill-advised tweets. I mean, even in the context of the Gaza thing, I've sent tweets that maybe weren't as well considered as they might have been. Got a little blowback yesterday, in fact. But here's one thing that interests me. I gather you would say that, I mean, you and I are on different sides of this particular issue, probably. Maybe not opposite sides. It's not that simple. I'm not like a Hamas enthusiast or anything, but we probably see this issue differently. Would you say that the way you assessed that photo and the blog post about it was framed, influenced by your position on the issue?
Well, I think it's not so much my position on the issue, because I can see. Look, I, for example, I have strong opinions on what's going on in Venezuela right now. But if I see images that come out of Venezuela, I take them more or less at face value, whether they tend to be pro-regime or anti-regime. That we don't have a pattern there, I believe, as best as I understand it, of the image management as a tool of politics. What image management, however, has been a real tool of the anti-Israel campaign over the past, especially decade, and both outright fabrication and falsification, as we saw in Lebanon, and more, and even probably more importantly, the framing of images so as not to show things. And that has been very true of this Gaza conflict, that in Gaza, the problem with the images we see are the images we don't see. If all you know of this war is what are these very powerful images, it looks like a war being waged by only one side. And you kind of wonder how anyone on the Israeli side has been hurt or injured or killed, because what you see is bombs going off in the middle of this third world city, and you don't see anything that looks like an actual war. And that is an omission. That is a powerful framing of shaping of reality through the omission of images.
Yeah, but I mean, you know the old saying in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. And you would concede there's been a lot more bleeding in Gaza than in Israel, right? I mean, I know a lot of rockets have gone over to Israel and so on, but there's been a lot more carnage in Gaza, right? So so I guess I'm asking, yeah, you really need to posit bias to explain.
What we see. The thing that when you say about the shaping, what you don't see is you don't see what that there is any kind of Hamas war effort going on, and that's partly in the nature of things. The Hamas people are, as I understand, in bunkers underground. They don't allow the press access. It's partly, there are many reports that there are various kinds of intimidation. There are deals about access that always have to be negotiated in these war zones. So there's a shaping of reality that concern, and that is that it's a different thing. So he says it's shaped by my politics, my reaction to these images. I'm sure, but it's also shaped by well-grounded experience. But that there is an image management that is an important tool of war on the part of those who are waging war in Israel.
Okay, but we had Wolf Blitzer of the supposedly liberal CNN, taking us through a tour of the terror tunnels, and this is explaining this is what Israel fears. Jody Rudoran of the New York Times, front page piece, the tunnels. This is just the other day I looked at a New York Times kind of a day-by-day log, I guess they've been keeping track of the casualties every day. And every day they had a picture. And I went down, was going down it, and I saw, wow, there's about as many pictures of Israelis, people grieving at a soldier's funeral or whatever, as there are Palestinians. And I thought, you could argue that it's this balance is unbalanced in the sense that the yes. vast majority of the deaths have... So, I mean, I'm not...
What the photos don't show you, though, is what's this... Why is there this... is there a war going on, or is one side just pounding from the sky non-resisting people on the other side? Yeah. And that's the thing that I, so when you say why why am I disposed to be skeptical of images? It's not just because I'm sympathetic to Israel, though I certainly am sympathetic to Israel. But in other cases where I have sympathies, image skepticism would not be a way that my sympathy would express itself because it wouldn't be necessary. We wouldn't have experience with that particular problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask you, do you think the problem that you perceive, an anti-Israel bias in the media, which I don't actually perceive in America.
By the way, I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. So how would you put it?
What I would say is I don't think that the center of the problem here is at least the American media. And I think that actually given what happened in Lebanon in 2006, I think there's a lot more media caution this time about taking the media have been more cautious. It's a strategy that is practiced by a combatant, the Hamas side. They have an image management strategy. And there are limits to how much media organizations can penetrate that. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons I felt bad about criticizing the New York Times photographer is I don't know really what kind of danger he's in and what kind of risks he's running. And there are real limits on what he can show, and I'm sure he would like to show more. But image management is such an important part of the strategy, and that means we have to be realistic consumers of the images we see.
Okay, but how does Hamas realize this image management policy? I mean, my understanding is that the journalists in Gaza are free to go wherever they want. There are journalists in Israel who can go wherever they want. So how is Hamas controlling or influencing the imagery?
Well, they can. It's not true. You can go wherever you want. I mean, we read reports, for example, that central command of Hamas is located in a bunker underneath one of the major hospitals that was dug before Hamas took control of the Gaza territory. I don't know whether that's right, but a lot of people who are knowledgeable report it. So let's say, argue, for the sake of argument, that it is. Obviously, you can't go in there. You can't follow the Hamas. You can go into the tunnels after the Israelis clear them out. Mm-hmm. You can't go into the tunnels when the Hamas people are there, poised to emerge and to strike.
So, although conveniently, they provided some video themselves recently of one of their strikes emerging from the tunnels.
Yes, they. Right. So that goes to this point about image management. That means that as consumers of images, we have to be wary consumers.
Okay. Now, do you think that you're not calling this a problem of media bias?
In Europe, I think things are a little...
Okay. How do you assess the reaction to this relative to the previous Gaza campaigns? I guess this is like the third, right? And then there was the Lebanon war. I mean, there have been two in Gaza. So do you think that opinion is growing less favorable toward Israel over time? I mean, some people are saying they sense a difference, something changing. Do you?
Well, that's a very complicated question, and we're going to be impressionistic, so I want to be careful. But here are some of the differences. I'm not going to try to weight all of these. One difference is, I think, as compared to 2008, there is less government-to-government pressure on Israel than there was that time. And I think that is Hamas is an isolated entity. It is. It doesn't have many friends in the Arab world. Certainly not in the region. I think the ISIS campaign reminds people of what these kinds of jihadist movements really stand for. That how dangerous they are and how deadly.
I would say there are distinctions between the two, but go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, of course. ISIS does seem sort of newer, fresher, less corrupt,
crazier.
crazier. And there's a tendency of these movements, you start highly ideological, then you have to fund the movement, and then over time, money sticks to the hands of the people who lead the movement, and then the movement becomes complacent, corrupt, and rich, and Hamas is on that trajectory. I mean, there is this interesting question of how much money do the leaders of Hamas have. They certainly have more than the leaders of ISIS seem to have. I think Israel seems to be under less government-to-government pressure than it was in 2008. At the same time, from what I can see, the reaction in the streets of Europe against Jewish citizens and visitors seems to be more violent, more aggressive, and there do seem to be you know, this strange polarization of American politics is now arriving at the Middle East issue. That didn't used to be the case. There used to be a strong bipartisan consensus, and not just among elites, but among members and supporters of both parties. You can see continued drift among Democrats, and especially among more liberal Democrats, away from Israel.
And why do you, so an example I think would be John Chait. I don't know if you read his piece in New York Magazine about why he's less pro-Israel than he used to be. Why do you think it is, if this is happening, that among liberals, and including, I would say, and I was talking to Lisa Goldman at New America about this recently on Blogging Heads. She was saying among liberal Zionists, you're seeing some you know, disenchantment with Israel.
I think both on the right and the left, we're actually reacting to the same thing in different ways. In the 1990s, we had this tremendous period of optimism about the possibilities of a solution. Mm-hmm. And I was a big, by the way, just I was a big supporter of the Oslo process. I mean, in the 1990s, there are very, very large peace is to be desired, and
peace. You're going to go down as pro peace.
No, I would say that well, who isn't? But what I was going to say is that in the 1990s. The pro-Israel community was broadly united around the willingness to make very, very deep concessions in order to have a real, meaningful peace. I think in the years since the Second Intifada, there has been a loss of faith in the possibility of that kind of real peace. And what has happened is that, so the center ground has become less stable. And we've seen this inside Israel, that the former centrists have moved somewhat to the right there. Not that they're more hawkish. And I don't even think I'm more. I think we're just more pessimistic. And I think on the left, you've seen that too. We're all more pessimistic. And then we filter, our commitments are shaped. You know, our commitments may be changed by that. But what Jonathan Chait, I think, was saying was in 1998, he believed there was going to be a real peace deal, and he was enthusiastically in favor of it. And now, as Israel copes with the consequences of there being not a real peace available to it, that makes him more critical of Israel's actions. In my case, it makes me more sympathetic and sensitive to Israel's security situation, and more skeptical of proposals for concessions, especially when initiated by Israel. Mm-hmm. That said, I think it's still true today that if there were a trustworthy interlocutor on the Palestinian side who was talking about real peace, I think within Israel and within the American Jewish community, you would have an 80% consensus in favor.
Although I think one thing I'm hearing from people like John Chait is that it's not just growing despair, but I think he articulated the belief that the failure to reach a deal, including in this last round of negotiations, the blame for that failure lies partly at Israel's feet. And I think he said that explicitly.
Partly is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
What's that?
The word partly is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
Well, but it stands in contrast to what you just said, which is that we're just waiting for somebody on the Palestinian side who wants, you know, who's a trustworthy interlocutor or something. I mean, I'm just saying that I don't think that's the view that is driving some liberals away from Israel.
No. But the stimulus is the same. In on both right and left, and in the shrinking former center, that the hopes of Oslo have really dissipated, yeah. And people are reacting in different ways to the dwindling of those hopes.
Right, but I would say that one of the reasons hope started dwindling with me some time ago. I mean, I wrote a couple years ago at The Atlantic, where you are now, that I thought a two-state solution was dead. And for me, one reason I said that is because one thing that's happened over the years is Israel's built more and more and more settlements. And some of those have to be uprooted as part of a deal. And the more settlements you got, the bigger a constituency you've got that is against uprooting them, and the more implausible it becomes that you're ever going to have the political will to do it. And this is just, you know, I think that's we probably don't want to get into an extended argument about who's to blame,
But if you say, why is there, to go to your question, is there a change of mood among liberals and progressives? I think there is, in the same way that in Israel there has been a change of mood, that the old center has moved farther to the right, and in America liberals and progressives have probably moved to the left. But you say why? I think it's the same thing that there was a time when there really seemed to be plausible hope of a solution in our lifetimes, and now that hope is harder to see. That doesn't leave me pessimism is not the same as despair.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the problems that look unsolvable suddenly become. I mean, Ireland is the outstanding example. It's just grinding misery. It doesn't seem solvable, and then suddenly the will to solve the problem is found. Mm-hmm. And once the will is there, a lot of technical problems like settlements that once seemed so important suddenly don't. Do you even remember the terms of the Good Friday Agreement and all? Who remembers that except specialists, and probably not even many of them. That a will to coexist was found, and the technical problems were overcome.
I do know that nobody had to be physically relocated for that deal, and I just think, you know, I was in the West Bank in 2011, and just the infrastructure, not just the settlements, but the whole infrastructure is now so substantial. And as you said, the polity in Israel seems to be moving to the right, making a deal, if anything, less likely. But so... Do you think, you've been paying attention to this thing in Gaza, you've seen all the criticisms. Do you have any criticisms of Israel's policy yourself, or you think this is what they're doing there is kind of fully defensible?
Well, I'll say this. Before the ground campaign began, I had a lot of qualms about a ground campaign. I didn't see what it was going to accomplish that was going to be worth the lives of the soldiers and damage Israel's international reputation and the lives of civilians in Gaza. I didn't see what the gain was going to be. And I worried about that. I worry that that whether this is going to make sense. But my criticisms of Israel are prudential, not existential. I think that they have very, very difficult problems, there are not obvious good answers. The people who must deal with those problems are conscientious, humane people, and it's not for those of us who live in greater security to be cavalier about the decisions, to be judges of the easy judges of the decisions that people on the firing line have to make.
Not easy judges, but as long as America has the relationship with Israel that it has and is now resupplying ammunition and stuff, I think it's an important thing for Americans to think about. Do you think that the reaction? The images that are being conveyed from there and the whole publicity about the thing. Let me start by saying there have been more visible manifestations of anti-Semitism in Europe lately. Including some dramatic ones since the Gaza war started. Do you think the Gaza war, as it's being conveyed, increases the amount of anti-Semitism?
I think it activates it, but. Let me turn on the head something you said to me at the beginning about being predisposed to see something. There's been a lot of slaughter and cruelty in the Middle East over the past 3 years, especially. That does not seem to galvanize political reaction in Europe because there isn't, what are you predisposed to see? That when images come from Syria, when images come from Iraq, it doesn't generate there are people who are motivated to go and become jihadists in Syria from Britain or from Canada, Australia, and the United States. It doesn't generate the kind of intensity of feeling that these images from Gaza do in Muslim and non-Muslim populations in Europe. They are ready, and so when they get the stimulus, they respond.
Mm-hmm.
So it activates anti-Semitism, but if the question is. Is it absent? No, it's just lurking. It's just sometimes it's dormant, sometimes it's active, but it's ready to be triggered and to take available Jews in Europe as its target.
So you don't see that this as some kind of cost that should be factored into the decisions about whether to invade Gaza and stuff like that? Because you don't actually see it increasing the amount of anti-Semitism in the world.
No, I think we can measure. I mean, it's hard to measure, but there have been efforts to measure it. Anti-Semitism in Europe seems to be, it's driven by a lot of things. I mean, among the indigenous populations, the older settled populations, it seems to be a response to economic crisis. I mean, the state of Hungary just sent to, as its ambassador to the Vatican, somebody who seems to traffics in almost neo-Nazi talk about Jews. Does that have anything to do with Gaza, or does that express deep things in Hungarian history, the attempt to normalize the relationship with Hungary's past, the economic stresses of the European currency, I mean, put it this way, I think the Jews of Europe have enough to cope with without being told that it's sort of their own fault.
Nobody's saying that it's the fault of the Jews in Europe.
Or it's the fault of the Jews that people.
Well, no, or that it's the fault of the Jews. I'm asking the question of whether a particular Israeli policy could contribute, however illogically, and it would be illogical precisely because Israel and the Jews are not the same thing, right? I mean, it is illogical to react to any Israeli policy, but I'm asking it. You know, it's illogical to react to an Israeli policy by becoming more anti-Semitic. But I'm asking whether, as a matter of fact, this sort of illogical dynamic is playing out. So I just want to be clear about what the question is.
Question is, do I think that events in Gaza can trigger incidents? That's obviously right. Right. And they do trigger it. Mm-hmm. The question, if I remember right, when that man went into the school in Toulouse, the Jewish school in Toulouse, and murdered school children, there didn't happen to be a Gaza incursion going on at that moment. I was in Buenos Aires just a couple of years ago. I went to visit the very shabby little monument they have to how many people were killed in the attack on the Jewish community center there in 1993, if I think, remember the year right, like 85, 90 people and hundreds more wounded. There wasn't a Gaza incursion going on at that time. The world has never needed really compelling reasons to attack Jews. That it just seems to be something that people enjoy doing. One more thing I want to say, when you say it's illogical, it's true that European Jews are different from Israelis, and so in some senses it's illogical. But in another sense, I don't think Jews want to opt out. I don't want to say, leave me alone as a North American Jew. Leave me alone. This is Israel's problem. That people who are driven by the kind of hatred of Jews that we see in the streets of Europe and in some other places hate my kin. They hate me. They hate my family. And I don't separate myself from them by saying, well, I happen to have a different passport or a different accent or live in a different place.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I should emphasize, in a way, I consider this a generic question in a certain sense. In other words, I'm someone who's been arguing since 9/11 that the United States should be careful about generating more hatred of the United States abroad. It's one reason I oppose the war in Iraq and so on, and drone strikes and everything, because that tends to manifest itself in violence that can, you know, at home, ultimately, you know, potentially. So I'm very mindful of the possibility of this kind of blowback. In other words, I consider hatred the enemy. In the modern world where, you know, so much of the threat of violence and instability comes from non-state actors and even sometimes very small groups of people who seem to be motivated by hatred. You know, my view is hatred is the enemy. And if you have a policy that's going to generate more hatred of you, you should factor that into as a cost of the policy. So that's the reason I asked the question. At the same time, it's true that there are some distinctive aspects of it when it comes to the case of Israel and anti-Semitism, because it isn't just about hating a nation per se, and also because it has a long history.
Mm-hmm. Just on your more general point, there's certainly elements in truth to what in your description, I don't know that they point us to a solution. Where we've seen terrorism overcome. This is the 100th anniversary of the 1914 war, and let's not forget how much terrorism has been a part of, as an act of terrorism that ignited the First World War, and of course, in the chaos after the First World War, Germany and Poland and countries like that were ravaged by terrorism, disbanded soldiers who... I think you deal with that, ultimately, not by removing specific grievances, not by saying, well, we don't want to have Germany Freikorps men assassinating industry ministers, so I guess we have to let Germany win World War I. The answer is to raise the general level of well-being and prosperity in society so that these sociopathic individuals are more isolated. Mm-hmm. And when we think specifically of the problem of Israel-Palestine, I think one of the responses to the kind of pessimism about solutions that we see is to hope that we can do things that improve the quality of life for people on both sides of the line, and thus de-escalate, give people more reasons to find life valuable and to make them more optimistic that getting along with their neighbors is something worth doing.
So, I mean, are you agreeing that addressing grievances is part of the problem, or you're saying
quite? What I'm saying is that that grievances are not the angry mind looks for justifications. Look, we all know the difference between rationalizations and reasons, and that a lot of the stated causes of terrorist action are rationalizations rather than reasons. Their reasons may be unknown even to themselves, but there are conditions that make things possible. What are the grievances that ISIS has? They don't like the way Shiites worship. And so should Shiites stop worshiping that way so as to make ISIS less mad at them? A lot of these grievances are unresolvable, nihilistic, not worth resolving, not worth conceding to. But in any way, probably even in some hypothetical future where the Shiites agreed to be less Shiite, that I'm not sure that it would really make a difference.
Yeah, well, I think it's true that once groups get going, they amass evidence on their side of the argument and find reasons to keep going and so on. But I would say in the case of the Palestinians, the core grievances aren't in that same category as like they don't like the way Shiites work. I mean, you may hear some horrible rhetoric about Jews from Palestinians that is, at least as irrelevant as that issue of how Shiites pray. But what I mean is, the core grievances, the Palestinians, Palestinians in Gaza, there's like an economic blockade, for example. In the West Bank, they don't have full human rights, the right to due process and so on. They can't vote in elections that for the government that ultimately rules them and on and on and on. I mean, there are these grievances that we both hope a two-state solution would solve, but they're not kind of, facile.
But those, the conflict antedates every one of the grievances you mentioned. The conflict is way older than those grievances.
It's over land when it comes to Arabs and Jews, right? It goes back to conflicts over land.
It goes back to the very idea that there should be a Jewish settlement in the state of Israel.
Is about that, land.
Yeah, that, if this were about a two-state solution, there would have been a deal made in 1936 or 37. That's how long people have been proposing two-state solutions. Long before there was a Gaza blockade, this conflict was there. Even to the extent where you think, well, maybe the blockade somehow makes things worse, and then the blockade is lightened, and so it doesn't. But that doesn't push toward resolution. That means that they import a lot of cement with which to make tunnels, with which to fire rockets. And I think this is a bad week to point to the blockade as a the list of prohibited substances as a way to somehow ameliorate this conflict. If there were more stuff flowing into Gaza, there would be more war, not less.
Okay, then let's go to earlier weeks. I mean, just because I think this blockade thing is something that really does need to be discussed, and in a way this is the best week to discuss it because I think this is one of the root causes of this thing. But it's commonly said by critics of Hamas or whoever, critics of the Palestinians generically, maybe, that you know, when Israel withdrew from Gaza, there was some sort of, I don't know whether it came from philanthropic money or whatever. They built these greenhouses and, you know, gave them to the Gazans and said, here, this will help you, you know, make a living. Well, something I just read and what I think is a credible source is it turns out that when they grew their vegetables in the greenhouses, Israel would not let them export them because of the blockade. And they didn't want to dump them on the local market because, as in America, the farm lobby would not like that. And so that's the reason these greenhouses were not put to use. And I just think that's like a crucial fact, if true, right?
I can't begin to comment on that. I don't know anything about that. But here's what I would say. I think this is just generally true. It may be true that in any particular case that you can say the Palestinians reacted to a situation in a way that was destructive and violent, but you have to understand they were driven to it. But the fundamental choice to try to say, you know what, let's choose the path of cooperation. But and by the way, let's have some unfortunate, you know, from their point of view, realism about the power imbalance here. We're not going to get the deal we would like because we're not as strong. And countries all over the world have to adjust to these power discrepancies. And let's make something with what we've got. And I don't think that whatever you say about any about this greenhouse case, about which I know nothing, I don't think you can sustain the idea that Gaza's path, there was a big push to make a success of Gaza after the Israeli withdrawal, and just because of Israel, didn't go anywhere. There was a choice for conflict that seems embedded here, and that is the tragedy and unfortunate situation. And it goes back to the 1930s.
Well, what I'm suggesting is if they weren't allowed to export things during this big push to make them succeed economically, I just don't think like the decision, it was some kind of unilateral decision on this on their part for this not to succeed. But, you know, and I would say I think the Palestinians, or at least the negotiators, long ago reconciled themselves to getting nothing like the deal they would like. I mean, if you look at the things that supposedly the parts of the deal they had agreed to in the last failed attempt, there's a lot of stuff they were not part of their ideal deal, but you know, no sense to, I guess, relitigate that. Maybe we should in closing get a little become kind of pundits and try to imagine how this thing is going to play out. My sense at the moment is maybe that Israel seems to want a few more days to destroy more tunnels and stuff. So I think maybe it's unrealistic to hope for a ceasefire before then. I guess the problems I see with a ceasefire even then are the complications. I think Hamas has trouble letting this end without them being able to say something to the Gazans about what they got, and what they want is a lifting of the economic blockade in particular. I don't see Israel.
My understanding was the thing that they were most upset about was not being able to pay their civil servants. They have a huge public payroll. I mean, this is not the police and paramilitary, but this is government employees, so civilian government employees, have a huge payroll. That they were meeting that payroll with proceeds from various kinds of aid and various kinds of smuggling operations since the Muslim Brotherhood lost power in Egypt, that their ability to pay those salaries has been constrained very seriously, and that's the thing that impelled them. So they're looking for cash.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is, if I just had to guess, that is where whatever deal that is needed to put together some kind of ceasefire will take place. There will be some kind of payment of funds to enable payrolls to be met. Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe so. I mean, I think they need something they can point to, given all the suffering the Palestinians have endured. I mean, the other thing I'd say is, if they don't have that to point to and the missiles keep coming, I mean, I don't think. I mean, Netanyahu, until the missiles stop, has to. He can't stop fighting himself, right?
Well,
as a political matter, I mean, in Israel.
I don't know. I mean, if that's the case, then anytime anybody fires, then the other guy gets to decide when you go to war. If he can make you go to war by shooting a rocket at you, then the decision for war and peace has been consigned to somebody else, and that's a dangerous situation to be in. I think you're right. They probably do want to do some more damage to this tunnel network. But I don't see how this leads to any kind of political outcome. I really don't. And tunnels can be, of course, redug.
Yeah, yeah. But do you have a guess as to when we would see an actual bilateral ceasefire?
I wouldn't dare. I think one of the things that's really been striking about this has been that Hamas does have outside friends who have chosen to play an incredibly unhelpful role, including Turkey, a NATO partner. The leader of Turkey has just, if I recall this right, was just quoted saying he has no relationship with President Obama at all, doesn't talk to the United States. And the Qataris have played their own very mischievous part in paying for these tunnels. I think a big part of the solution here is to find is that Hamas's backers need to be put under more pressure to stop doing this. I mean, that backing Hamas is a dangerous actor. It's not dangerous just to Israel. It's dangerous. In fact, it's probably less dangerous to Israel than it is to other states in the region. We are witnessing, and our close, maybe this is the last, was a good place to sort of finish, our close aperture on Israel-Palestine means that we are losing sight of just the dissolution of the whole state structure of the Middle East, at least outside Egypt, over the past 3 or 4 years. And, Iraq and Syria, right now, in Libya, things are more quiet right now in Egypt than they were, but you have to be very nervous about that. And of course, the whole situation in the Persian Gulf is one collapse in the oil price away from, again, a flare-up of instability there. It's a very worrying set of problems, and of which, Israel, I mean, it's close to my heart and close to yours, I think, but some, the centrality of the story is fading. This is not as central a story as it used to be, as it used to be thought.
I think that's true, and I think things look grim generally. I mean, I guess there's one maybe mild source of hope I have that I don't think you have, which is I'm sufficiently cynical about human nature to think that, in general, people who run groups, people who run, political movements, whatever, are so fond of staying in power that they're often willing to change their ideology as necessary. So I don't have a kind of essentialist view of Hamas as being eternally committed to the destruction of the Zionist state. And I guess in closing, maybe I'd ask you what you thought of, I didn't see the Charlie Rose interview, but I gather that the head of Hamas in Qatar said, and they've made noises like this before, but I take it he said that in principle a two-state solution could work. Do I have that wrong, or do I have it right and you doubt him?
I didn't see the interview. I find it very – it is so central to who they are, that I find it incredible to imagine that. So, but I'll go – if you tell me, I'll go take a look at the interview. I would say one other thing, which is one of the – I've been – thinking a lot about one of Al Gore's favorite thinkers, a man named Thomas Homer Dixon, who wrote a lot in the 1990s about how environmental deterioration is going to be a source of conflict in the future. And I think that's a big part of why Middle Eastern problems seem so much worse now than they were. Egypt is now the largest importer of wheat in the world. You have these overtaxed systems, and you have a lot of underemployed young men in conditions that just seem to be getting worse for everybody. When I think about how can I imagine positive change, the change will not come from changes in ideology leading, leaders wanting to stay into power, because you're always going to, because then Hamas will just be outbid by the next Hamas. But what could happen is if some way population growth stabilizes, if there is some way of if economic growth can be ignited in Egypt, and that's this is a country that in the Middle Ages was the most advanced region of the world economically outside of China. I think things would suddenly look very, very different if that could be made to happen. Of course, that's no less miraculous than any of the other things we've talked about.
No, but at least I think we can close on a point of agreement, which is that a young man with a job is going to be less likely to be attracted to an extreme ideology than a young man without a job.
Don't forget the girlfriend.
Okay, David, it looks like we got cut off there. Your Skype signal had been so strong for so long. Something happened.
I'm sorry about that. The technology does fail us from time to time, but most of the time, it's our good friend.
I don't hold you personally responsible, but I did want to say thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for the forum, Bob. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. Enjoy Toronto.
Bye-bye.